Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Dennis McGrath, here with technical producer Philip Vukovic. Jill Golic, the regular host of this program, was recently selected president of the Writers Guild of Canada. Congratulations, Jill. Now, with her spanky new responsibilities, Jill and I will be sharing hosting duties going forward. Speaking as a big fan of the program, and writers in general, I'm excited to be here. It is a scorcher here in Toronto, the kind of night you long for a long, cool drink, some great TV, and a whole mess of air conditioning. With me here in the cool is tonight's guest, Frank Van Keeken. He's the showrunner of one of the Family Channel's newest series, Winging It. Actually, it's very funny to have our guest here tonight, Frank Van Keeken, because, of course, I've heard your name for years, and I think I've seen you on stage, and I've seen you, you know, I've sort of, I saw you and were aware of you before I even dreamed of writing. So it's kind of a trip to have you here,
and
really great to have you here. And you have a very interesting and varied career. I know Jill liked to keep it very sort of focused. I'm going to widen it out a little bit just because Frank has had a lot of interesting experience writing, you know, a lot of different things, including some you know, half-hour comedy stuff like Billable Hours, was it?
Seasons
2 and 3 of Billable, right. So, but we're mainly here tonight to talk about tween comedy Winging It, which is, I'll just read the description because it's probably the easiest. Reckless angel in training, Porter has been sent to Earth to earn his wings by transforming hapless student Carl into the most popular kid in school. If Porter succeeds, he'll get real wings and a halo. If he doesn't, it'll be 1,000 years before he gets the chance to try again, and Carl will still be unpopular. Pretty cool. Was there something from one of your early gigs that was a good craft lesson that you picked up from somebody? What was the most important thing that you learned on the job when you were brand spanking new?
As a sitcom writer, like my first sitcom gig?
Sure.
I think the most important rule is you're there to serve the showrunner. Mm-hmm. So whatever you do, are you helping the showrunner? If not, don't do it. And a lot of people don't remember that rule. Care about that rule know that rule.
Is that a particularly is that universal in Canada and the States? Is it more of a Canadian thing?
That they don't know?
I think I know what you're getting at in the sense that, you know, you sometimes run across writers that, you know, the point is they're there to express themselves and express their creativity more like it's a creative writing sort of thing. Whereas what you're saying is something very practical that I think is very true, and I've seen writers just really miss the mark by not doing that. But is that something that, you know, that all new writers equally have to face, or does that happen more here? Does it happen more in the States?
I think it happens. I think it varies. One of the things I've sort of discovered is that because we're Canada's basically a social welfare state, there's a sense of I'm going to digress a couple of times probably before I answer the question, but there's a limit to how high we can go, and we perceive that, and also how far we can fall. So we don't try as hard. And I find that the work ethic of a lot of my writers in Canada is Canadian. Mm-hmm. And when I was working in the States, if you don't do well, you go home, and they don't care, you know, you're going to die. So people really work hard, and they'll do whatever it takes to prove themselves. I noticed that in terms of service too. Most of the service in Canada sucks. And in the States, the service is great. No matter where you go, it's great. You go to the equivalent of a Tim Hortons or wherever, it's unbelievable service. And you could call anyone up and say, I need an elephant. And someone will go, okay, there's one in Texas, and we got a guy, he's got a Sikorsky helicopter, and he's gonna fly it in, and we'll have it on set. And in Canada, they'll go, there's a guy I know has an emu. Are you willing to work with an emu? I go, no, I wrote in an elephant. So on a lot of levels, some of it's budgetary, obviously, but there's this sort of like, you know, they don't want to stay out late. And in the States, writing rooms, you go home at 2 or 3. That's okay. And you're still there at 9 in the morning. And you'll do that till you drop. And here it's like, Idol's on tonight.
There does seem to be a lot of, I think I call it good enough, right? There's a lot of, I think that the best writers, I think, are doubters, are the ones that are like, shit, it always can be better, and I want to make it better. And you sometimes run across a lot of writers here who are like, it's good enough. And I think that's sort of limiting. How do you get around that? How do you inspire people to do better than that?
I yell at them.
Oh, good. So it's the old-fashioned way. That's good.
I basically lead by example. My writers generally go home before me, and I'm there before them. It enrages me that that's the case, because when I'm in production, we're actually shooting, I'm on set from the first minute I'm there. I watch every frame that goes through the video cameras. And my writers, they trundle in around 10, and, around 7, we should go home. I think we've done it, In the States, not to compare it to that, and I enjoy both places for different reasons, but you're there. Like, you'd never go home before your showrunner, ever. And some of it, too, maybe they're not paid enough. I know you get more money in the States than you do here, but it's just this kind of attitude that I just try and lead by example, and I'll yell at them. It's like, this is not good enough. Like, suck it up, man up, woman up, whatever the politically correct term is, but get it done. Like, dare. I guess a lot of it is to dare to dream big. Mm. Dare to to have the best show in the world. Well, yeah, you're gonna get kicked in the nuts on budget, on your cast, on how long you're going to get to shoot an episode, on all these different things, but still dare to make it the best you can do. And that's not so much as good enough, because good enough means you don't care. This is, I don't dare to dream big enough, which is cowardice and fear, I think, and lack of diligence.
I think you make an interesting point, too, about the economic aspect of it, too. That even when, it's hard when people, there's so few actual writing jobs and so few people that are actually making their living exclusively writing, although the percentage of that in the Writers Guild of Canada is actually higher than the WGA, which is weird. It is amazing that even when you're on a show and even when you've got the what should be the best job in the world if you want to be a writer, there is the sad and terrible truth that, it's not enough. You might only get one of those jobs every 2 years, and it's not enough to live on for 2 years. Like, it's a, you can't. It's almost like the system forces you to not throw yourself heart and soul into the entire show because you've always got to be thinking, oh shoot, what's my next gig going to be? And that might be limiting too.
Well, yes. Although I would say that that's counterproductive because, I'm always trying to develop this sort of group of people I can carry forward to shows. And I'm in the same boat. Like, I've been in show business for decades. And I always, I would joke in the writing room, I'm always months away from, trying to get a Jimmy Two Shoes. Mm-hmm. That's everyone's reality. Now, I haven't suffered from that. But part of that is due to the fact that I am indomitably positive and hardworking, and I just do not give up. I do not give up until I it's shot, and then I work so hard on the editing and whatever. It's like, if you're not that, then what? Like, how long does a gig have to be before you're going to care? It's never going to be that way. And I would rather have sins of commission in the room where people are overextending themselves with idiotic ideas than someone who perches in a chair and every once in a while gives me a little bon mot or bon mot, whatever the, a little clever. I don't care. I don't need that. I need just, put it out there.
Mm. You raised a really interesting point there in your answer, which I've heard before for a lot of senior writers in this country, which is this incredible desire to find the people and to take people along with you when you find people that actually can do the work and that are actually great and that you want to work with those same people again and again. So I guess maybe that leads to the question of what, you've sort of answered this, but if there's anything else you could say about what can a young writer or a junior do to impress you beyond sort of, you know, being the showrunner's will and throwing lots of ideas. What are the other good habits of somebody that distinguishes themselves from the people who maybe aren't trying as hard?
When I first moved to, I spent a decade or so in Los Angeles, and I had a reasonably good career here as a stand-up and a bit of a reputation. You know, I was like on the cover of I Weekly once, and you know, stuff like that. And I moved to the States, and I had this whole big little, you know, bag of tricks that I could bring with me, the skill set. But I had to start over. And I was writing specs, and no one gave a rat's ass. I mean, I had a Frasier. I had a Get a Life. I had a Simpsons. I mean, I just relentlessly wrote, and no one cared. And so finally I said, well, I'm just going to write what I want to write, what I believe in. And I wrote this script called Johnny Incorrigible. And my agent, I think, still sends it out as a sample. It was written well over a decade ago. And it was, I think I would do a rewrite on it today, but it had something in it that was me, and it was beautiful. It was just, it was what a cool little thing. And that script got me Mad About You. They tried to make the show. We had different actors come in, and it was sold, and it opened doors for me. And the lesson I took from that was, and it wasn't by, didn't, you know, ensure success, but I just believed in myself. And I know that sounds horrible, you know, syrupy, but why are you doing this? Like, if you're doing it for a paycheck, become a lawyer or a doctor or a dentist, because you'll make more money. Mm. But you can make a lot of money as a writer. I mean, you know, Larry David's third syndication sale was $110 million or some stupid thing like that. That's the third time it's gone around. Like, he's made close to $1 billion off that show. Friends has generated probably $20, $30 billion in revenue. There's a lot of money. And even in this pathetic country in which we live, you can still do really well for yourself. You get a show that can syndicate and plays well, and you know, like we can all make an office.
Yeah.
You know, that was what? How many episodes? 15 episodes, and you know, Ricky Gervais can, you know, pee in gold toilets if he wants now, right? Off of those 12 episodes, right? And the pilot I heard was, and they had to reshoot it, and but so it's possible. It's a long shot. There's not that many of them out there, right? But believe in yourself. Like, what is it in you that's so good? If you can't answer that, go home. You got to go. I don't hold a candle to anyone, right? Like, I believe I'm the and I don't have all the answers. There are better joke writers, better story people, right? There's better punch-up people, better people at editing, right? But half the time, I'll fake it till I make it. That's not to mean that I'm going to lie about my abilities. I'm very honest to say, I don't know what you're talking about. And they'll go, well, we just shot a cut. That means the scene's over. Ah, okay, good. All right. I should know that, right? So whatever. It's okay to be stupid about stuff if you're honest about it. But believe in yourself. Like, I think it's paramount. And also, develop a skill set. Hmm. Like, I've written hundreds of episodes, sitcoms, hundreds of them, pilots. Like, I probably have 20 original pilots that I've written. And I don't know how I could sit down and calculate all the shows that I've been on. I'm just now getting good, right? It'd take me that long. So if you're only going to write a script, you pump one out every 2 or 3 years, it's going to take you 30, 40 years before you're good.
Mm. That's good advice. Let's transition to talking about winging it. I've heard various sort of pieces of opinion on this question, but tell me about the process of getting that show off the ground. Is doing a show for that age group, is it exactly the same as doing a sitcom?
It's exactly the same.
Yeah?
The only thing is, I would say the stories are different in only two ways. One is that you can't have characters with too much subtext so that we know what they're really saying, even though they're not saying that. which is sort of more clever writing, you know, more introspective, complected, that verb exists, or maybe it's an adjective, characters. In Kitcho, what they say is what they are. So you need to be clever about that, because that's the only thing that the kids at home generally take from that. And then number two, like I did two seasons of Billable Hours. That show stank of cynicism. I mean, it reeked of it. And now I'm doing an aspirational show where an angel comes to help you. Right? Same shit, right? Yeah. My show now is just hopeful. And I've said this recently. This is a recent understanding in myself. I was much more hopeful when I was younger, but wrote very cynical stuff. And now I'm very cynical, but I just want to write hopeful stuff, right? And I don't know, and Roger commented yesterday, I think I trotted that out in some meeting we had, and he said, I wonder what that day was when they were in equilibrium. Yeah. I don't know if that was a good day for writing or not, but there's no difference between kids' television. The network knows what they want. So I go, what do you want? Okay, let's try and give you that and still imbue it with my ideas of what a TV show should be.
Great. Well, so talk to us about how did Winging It come to be? Was it something that you pitched? When did you come up with the concept? What was the genesis of it? What was the process of pitching it?
I just recently moved back from Los Angeles for various and sundry reasons, I'd moved to Stratford because I was sort of done with cities. And I still don't live in Toronto. I live about 2 hours north on a farm. I think it was like winter, and I was standing looking out the window. It was like frightfully cold, and I was thinking to myself, what the f*** am I done coming here? And my agent called and said, Disney is looking for some shows. Have you got anything? And I said, as I always would, yeah, of course I do. And I didn't really have anything. I said, okay, we'll get them on the phone. So I had a day or two to get something together. And I had this notion in my head about Angel coming down and helping someone. And wouldn't that be fun? That's it. Angel on Campus is what I originally called the show. So the Disney people called, whatever the level where you start the kind of development process, the bottom development food chain, rung, whatever. And I pitched the idea, and they like this, and this could work. And so I walked it up the ladder at Disney, all through just telephone calls and emails, and me staring out in the bleak, cold, snow-belty winter of Stratford. And eventually, they bought the idea. They said, oh, let's do this, and I forget who the boss was there, and this is great. And then they called my agent to negotiate how much they wanted to pay me, and it sucked. It was like a kick in that. It was like, I was so offended. And I just said, politely, because I want to be in business with them potentially again, but I had my agent say, he doesn't want to do it for that amount of money. And so I just chucked it in a pile. Now, when my first managers when I had in L.A. were crappy managers. I have fondness for one. The other I thought was an idiot. But he did say one really wise thing is, the longer you hold on to something that you own, the more valuable it's going to become. So if you're a nobody and you go and pitch an idea, you're going to not get much money, and they're going to put another showrunner on it, and you might get moved out of the way. But if you wait till you're Aaron Spelling or J.J. Abrams, they'll give you a lot of money for it. So I didn't mind just chucking that thing on a pile. It's potential energy. And then I got my job show running Billable Hours, and that went well. And so Temple Street said, hey, have you got any ideas for shows? And I said, hey, I got the show that Disney has already approved. So it's all worked out already. Like I was like, it was like I had Disney beta testing my ideas.
Right.
I owe them money. And so we then started up the food chain at Family Channel. And it was very slow, and I'm used to that now in Canada. Because in the States, I'm thinking about going down in the fall and pitching ideas. I'll go down in September, and if I sell something, I'll write a draft by American Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I'll get notes within a week. And I'll turn that around at Christmas time, and they'll pick it up in January or February, and it'll be made, in February, March, April, it'll be greenlit in May. Like, it's 6 months, and then you don't have to worry about it. You got all your money, and, you know, and here it's like, it was like 2-3 years. But I had other stuff to do, and also, it's not like I was attached to it, right? I'd already just told Disney to go shove it, and I was like, you know, I didn't care. You can't care, right? You can't care about the outcome. You can only believe in what you're doing. You can't control who's going to buy it, you know? At Family Channel, they showed it, the boss there showed it to his kid, the demo we shot. Mm. And the kid liked it. Maybe that's why we're on the air. Can you imagine if he was mad at his dad that day? Yeah. I wouldn't be on the air, right? But to put any greater import in that, oh, I must not be a good writer. Oh, they don't understand me. Well, that's stupid. So it went up the food chain again at Family Channel, and they did the let's write 3 scripts. And I hate that. Like, just, here's a pilot. We'll shoot it. If you like it, let's make a series. We'll figure it out. We really will. But they have all this way. They have to put a certain amount of money to development, and you got to write a Bible. I've never, in the States, you never write Bibles. You write Bibles afterwards that remind you, you know, Jennifer had a baby in season 2, so that you don't pitch that. You give that to all the new writers. Oh, I won't pitch Jennifer has a baby, because they did that, that episode. That's the only reason for a Bible. But here it's all part of the, right? We're, again, a welfare state, right? We don't have show business because, the only reason we have show business is because the government is giving us money through Telefilm and Shaw and so all these funds, right? So it's completely a welfare state. The good thing is, it doesn't matter what happens in the rest of the world, they're still going to keep making this crap, right? It's good for us. But it does buffer some of the potential, you know. You have to be really crafty about that. So it just went up the food chain at Family Channel, and they responded quite well to it. They really fostered it. It was really championed by Swin Chang, who's ended up moving. I think she's at E1 now as a development executive. Really liked the show and was very encouraging and very helpful on many levels. So eventually we made a little demo, and it tested well. You know? Again, those kids not had enough Smarties coming into that. I might not be on the air, right?
So were you there in the room when they were testing it? Like,
are you
in
the back.
Behind the one-way glass?
Sure. And there's another lesson, too, because when I was like, I don't know, see what testing is. And I went to the testing, and I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. That's cool. Okay, I'm not going to do that. Oh, wow. Like, you could crowdsource all your story ideas by those people.
Hmm.
And when we tested winging it for as part of the renewal process for season 2, they were pitching ideas. Some of them we had already done. But I remember thinking, hey, that's good. It makes the show is making sense, and they can see the kind of shit that they want. Is this going to be bleeped? I guess it's on the internet, right?
Yeah, I think on the careful. Internet you can say f-
No, but I'm going to be... Yeah. I just want to... There's going to be young kids getting access to that. So I'll try not to...
Bleep this, right?
Can you put little...
No problem.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, it's going to be like, a lot of work for Philip.
It just went up the food chain. We did all the due diligence. And I was doing other stuff. I didn't attach a lot of importance to it. It could have gone away, right? But it's not. Somehow lingered. And I guess the lesson there is, if it's not kind of working, it's probably not going to work. And that's okay. If you only got one good idea, if you only got the pet rock, if that's all it is, well, hopefully that'll work for you. You make all your money and you can go home. But you got to have more than one idea.
Mm-hmm. A couple of follow-ups just on what you said in that. The first would be, based on those first testing reactions or development, how did the concept change in your development, or did it change at all from what you learned in the testing? And I guess the other part of that, what was the other part of that?
Well, let me answer that part.
Answer that part, yeah.
The original conception for the show, I wanted to have our hero more conflicted. I wanted everything to go wrong with him. And yet somehow he would find the nobility to rise in the face of all this adversity in his life. I thought that was noble. Kids go, he's a loser. Right? They can't see the complexion of that. They don't want to.
Mm.
So we had to make him more aspirational. That was one of the things we changed. And we also had a in this adversarial relationship, I also created a raccoon character that was attacking him. This guy, always attacking him for some wrong that this raccoon had received in its life. I don't know, I hadn't figured that out, but he had been wronged by Carl and he wanted to kill Carl, so he's always attacking Carl. The kid said, that's a horrendous looking puppet. I don't buy that. I can spend $9 or $11 and see James Cameron's latest trifling, right? For $11. My expectations are a little higher now. So, and you know, we spent $5,000 on this puppet. It's a ratty ass looking puppet. And I wanted it kind of to be a little bit frightening, and a little bit fake, and a little bit, but it just ended up being a lot stupid. Now, one of the stakeholders in the series is BBC. Worldwide are distributing this show. And then when it came time to pick up the show, Family Channel said, we love the puppet. That's water cooler talk. And BBC said, we're not making the show unless you lose the puppet.
Of course.
So I had to write this unbelievable missive, this polemic, this philosophical diatribe about the value of the puppet and how I was going to recontextualize it. And I did that. I said, well, it's not just an actual puppet. Like, it's not a raccoon in the real world. It's a minion of one of the angels. It's sort of a kind of a beast thing, kind of a, it's of the heavenly, you know, there's all this highfalutin stuff. And they said, okay, you can have your raccoon. We needed BBC to somehow agree. So we shoot the whole season with the raccoon, and there's a new regime at the network now, and one of the things they're saying, we hate the puppet. I had to put the puppet in there because of you guys. And now they hate the puppet. And we shoot all the stuff with the puppet. And then we tested in anticipation of season two. And the kids hated the puppet. It's like they hated it. So now the puppet's gone. But the raccoon is going to be gone in season two.
Okay. But you couldn't pull him out of season
one. I have
one.
Not. Hopefully my puppeteers haven't heard, will not listen to this podcast, because I've yet to make that unpleasant phone call.
Frank, we don't have a lot of listeners in the puppet community.
Oh, you never know. They hear things. And how to do that is going to be interesting. And so what I'm trying to do is maybe the puppet is, the name is Dennis. It's not Dennis. It's actually Denise. It's an angel in training that's been bewitched for several hundred years and under the care of Dr. Kasabi, and will become this 13-year-old girl who will become a nemesis to Porter and another character, potentially a spinoff. That's my dream now, right?
Oh, uh-huh, okay, good.
Right? That's where I'm going. It's going to be hard to convince the kids that this ratty-ass piece of cloth that you could buy at Walmart for $9.99 is going to turn into this beautiful, ethereal angel in training. Right? But I'm going to go for it.
Okay.
Right? And I might not get there, and I might have to cut it and edit it out, and it might not work, but I'm going to try and do it, because I don't want to just not have the puppet there anymore. Right? I want to find it. That would be really cool if I can pull that off.
So are you intrigued yet? I think I definitely am, right? A little bit of housekeeping before we show the episode. Is there anything you want to set up in terms of the particular episode we're going to screen tonight? And I guess the one sort of contextual thing is, can you tell us again what the age group is for the series? Who's the audience?
Well, I tried to do a dual departure sort of show,
mm-hmm,
where there can be some stuff. Like, my greatest hope is, like, the mom is walking by with the laundry, you know? They're looking at the TV, and eventually you just find her sitting there with the laundry, folding it by the kid. If I can do that, then I say, oh, my God, That would be fantastic. But the demographic for the network is, I don't know, 8 to 12 or 13-year-old girls and boys. You know, I don't necessarily write for that. I try to write, you know, and you'll see that the way I've kind of, the psychology of, we can get into some of this when we want to start talking about, like, how I construct a show.
Great.
But I read a book called, I can't remember the name of it, but it was written in the late 70s. It's published out of the University of, like, Austin, Texas, and it's a kind of deconstruction of the sitcom. And this guy said that up until like 80, that sitcoms were a reflection of society. And when you were in the early 60s with Leave It to Beaver and those very literal shows like Dick Van Dyke, that it was very much a one of those you know, fear of the nuclear war kind of realities, where your central character was good and solid, and everyone else around him was an idiot and untrustworthy. And Leave It to Beaver, this core family, shows like My Three Sons, Andy of Mayberry, very traditional, really kind of like that outside world, right? Raleigh in Andy of Mayberry was, they're you know, loose women there, right? Barney Fife might say. And then into the late 60s, you get, again, as a reflection of society, sitcom loses its mind. You get I Dream of Jeannie, you get Bewitched, you get My Favorite Martian. I mean, in one episode of My Favorite Martian, the Martian turns the guy into a puddle and a dog drinks him. I can imagine trying to pitch that? That snoring? And then as we leave that 60s period, that psychedelic period, we go into sitcom in its most literate form, and we get into the triumvirate of sitcoms, Mary Tyler Moore and All in the Family and MASH, where it's sort of the pinnacle almost of that kind of stuff. And then it sort of dies until, you know, Cosby rejuvenates it in the 80s. But I think we're very much in a place psychologically like that early 60s period. We're very frightened in society. I mean, we're screwed on so many fronts right now. And so I think that appeals on a kind of psychological level again. So I constructed a show where my core characters are the sane ones. And then the level outside of them, the first group of kids, are a little bit nutty. And then the parents are the adults are really nutty. So that's a psychology that no one will ever know except in the room, right? Mm. And that's something I delineate. I'll talk about it. I sort of analyze stuff in a very kind of Zen Jungian construction when I'm building my characters. Even though you're not going to see that on the page, it's sort of there subtextually. And that really helps me in writing and also in people's pitches. When they pitch an idea, I'll tell them this is why. And if you don't honor that in your character, you'll get yourself into trouble. But you'll see that reflected in, even in this episode, to some degree. Now, I was going to show two episodes. The first episode is a little more freaky doodle, not as freaky doodle as we go. But it's a nice place for where the show should be regularly. And it was fraught with problems in shooting it and all kinds of stuff, but it turned out quite well in the end. So I think we'll show that. And I think there's a little teaser off the top as a kind of like fill you in. It was a promo that got sent out that was reworked. We put on a new the theme song that this group, Stereos, has done for the show. So I guess we can show that. And then this episode called Spinner and the Saint. Which is, I think, a kind of ideal version of where this series should be, how it should play in terms of our two leads. They're both working together against a common foe.
Great. Okay. Well, let's take a look at it, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more. Well, that's great. Nice work. nice.
Yeah, it's 3-day shoots.
3-day, that's a lot of action for 3 days.
A lot of action. 3-day shoots, and half my cast is under 16, so I have very limited time with my actors, too. They pumpkin, so it can be a rough ride, but and for better or for worse, it's a pretty trippy show, but mm-hmm. that's, you know, a bunch of people going, let's go for it. Let's just, like, there's some cool shit going on there. It doesn't always work. We're trying to make stuff better. You know, there's huge issues, CGI issues, in-house effects. Just that episode, too, we hired dance choreography people. We had a dance double for Surge. It's huge.
Yeah. Tell me about your cast a little bit. Did you, you know, there's that thing that sometimes, you know, you find you start writing to your casting a little bit more. Did you, were these guys the guys that you had in your head? Like, did you find what you were, or did you change it, or how did casting change what you did?
When I did my initial casting for the demo, we had Porter and Carl cast, and I kept the mother and Becky, the daughter. But I changed everyone else out. I brought Surge in. Surge is my son, actually, and he had never acted before, but I couldn't find this role. And we always used to do goofy crap together. We'd shoot videos and edit them just for fun to do stuff in our downtime in Stratford. And I thought he could maybe pull this role off because you've got to be an ass and yet really endearing and stupid and kind of likable. And it's not it's a really hard role. And I read people after people to try and get this right. And so I said, you know what, go in and try it. I think you can do it. And it was very conflicted for me because, you know, it's nepotism. And I even deferred when we were casting, once the show got picked up to do casting for the series, I made him read again. He had to come in and read against other actors. And I wasn't 100% sure because there were better actors, but they couldn't get the funny like he did. And so we ended up going with him. But never been in front of a camera before. Alex, the same. Never been in front of a camera before. Jane had rarely done one episode some sitcom, some kid show. That's all she had done. So my cast, a lot of them had not done much. But some of them were more experienced. And so the cast changed a lot. And then you start writing for, you know, like Surge speaks in the third person. We do that now, right? Surge always wears a uniform. That just kind of somehow came out of either the writing room or he might have said that. He might, you know, like there's that kind of synergy you can develop with your cast. Like the girl that plays Becky comes up with lots of lines. The sister, you know, she's like a little Borscht Belt. We write her as this Borscht Belt comedian. So that kind of give and take. And Serge does a lot of by so-and-so, I mean that. And by that, I mean, like mm-hmm. he does these, there's Serge-isms. Alex, we're going to do a whole series this year of don't ask. Like, he finds himself in situations that you don't even want to know how it happened. And so we're going to do these kind of little sort of kind of vignettes with him. So you start writing to what they're, and this maybe goes back to understanding the gestalt of that character. Like, who is this? What is the essence? I'll very quickly, and this is somewhat borrowed and somewhat thought out on my own and some of my own musings and practically over the years, but very quickly, what drama is, what story is people having a false sense of themselves. And in a movie, that false sense is uncovered to some degree. Right? I'm just a bum, right? Rocky, right? Mm-hmm. That's his false, right? Dan, 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 dan. The goose flesh, and oh my God, no, he's not, right? Adrian, right? It's like, it's magical. It's like that. If you, they all have these things uncovered in themselves. And narrative is the uncovering of that. It's very Jungian, right? It's what are all the unlived lives in each human being that ulcerate and cause you trouble in your life and also keep you safe? And that tension gives you the impetus of a character. And I wax philosophical in the room sometimes, and I know they just glaze over, but I keep hammering away, and I try and inculcate that into their storytelling sense. And I have a very intuitive sense of this, but it's also rigorously worked out. So when someone says, Alex does this, and I go, well, Alex wouldn't do that, but Jane would do that. So each of these characters have things to uncover. Now, in sitcoms, you can never uncover. If you uncover, you jump the shark, mm-hmm. right? That's what happens. So you have to delay the uncovering as much as possible. So you always have these little resets at the end, little Quinn Martin epilogues,
right?
Where everything is, the buttons are reset, and next week these, you know, group of idiots are going to do it all again for you. But you do start writing to them, and write. So each character brings, as an actor, their own energy. And if you can really feel that and see, oh, look, that's nice. I like what they do there, what they're good at. And I push my actors too. Like, I'm very hands-on. Like that credit sequence, I worked out that credit sequence because my design team that we outsourced this to was coming up with shit. So I wrote that narrative for that, and I shot it. I was actually there on the day we shot it, and I had my crew there and whatever, and I bugged the effects house, and we came up with the beaming in and beaming out. We do that in-house. But I'm on the show. Every second that's shot, I'm there. I edited everything. All the music, I sit in, I go to looping, everything. The only thing I don't do, I don't do like loop group, but I'll go to all the ADR. And we add lines. Mm. There's lines there that weren't said, but on the day, it's cut. And we'll go, oh, I'm going to tuck that in. But Becky says, nothing to look at here. She's going off. We added after, right? That kind of stuff. So I'm never letting it go until it's done. And it's a very collaborative effort. That's not to say I'm this maniacal guy. I want people to bring their game, and I'm surprised. Like the production design there, it's fantastic. Bill Layton did wonders making that gym look the way it was. That's a ratty ass gym. It's an abandoned Catholic elementary school. You know, it's crappy. No one's been in it for years, and we you know, it, sometimes it looks like that, but we made, you know, he did a great job, and Sheila Fitzpatrick, who did my costumes. She's got a whole look, like there's a kind of 60s vibe. I told her, and I said, I have this, I, you know, I told a little bit about, I want this to have a kind of an old-timiness to it. And so if you see some of the costumes, like Malone and Mrs. Lennox, you haven't seen this episode, and Dr. Kasabi, they're almost old English-style dress, you know? And that's, again, just this kind of energy that's there. And it gives it a kind of point of view that's unique.
Somebody, I think, once said that, you know, effective television is about bringing the new to the familiar. And with that, with the cast of characters you have there, what's interesting about it is that you have these very recognizable types, but you know, you've got the wacky kid from space, I get, or whatever, all that seven characters comedy stuff. But what's interesting about it is that you invert a lot of it. You know, like, I mean, the angel guy is the cool guy, but at the same time, you know, he's clearly making mistakes, and he's clearly not up to the task of being a full angel, and you've got the... I was very taken by surprise by the characterization of the popular girl, because, you know, that's such a key role that we've seen it 100 times before, but I don't know if I've ever seen that kind of hit on it before. Is that something that, you know, as that developed, was that all there in what you pitched to your writers and stuff?
Yeah, that's all in the original pitch document. Hannah Lochner, who plays Brittany, brought her own kind of take to it. And, you know, I read Brittany, or I read Hannah before the demo. And she was kind of caught between being the Jane character and being the Brittany character. And I liked her for Brittany. And we ended up hiring someone else who was a horrid actor but really easy on the eyes, which was what that role requires. And then when we were doing casting, the woman who reads for Jane, who did Jane, came in and read for Brittany and knocked it out of the park. And one of my producers at Temple Street had the foresight to say, the money role, the big role, is the Jane role. Like, maybe she should do that. And so then I brought Hannah back, and I tried to get her to this Brittany area. And we've worked. She doesn't actually want to necessarily go there, but I push her to there. And her good thing is, like, she can be horrible at everything she does. No one's going to care because everyone loves her. She's Brittany. And we have talent show episodes. There's another episode, actually, where she, you know, that's not the talent show. It's Dramarama. It's a different episode. But whenever she does, she's horrible at it, but everyone loves her. She's rich. She's an untouchable.
Right.
You know, she in a kind of she is really Kramer. Even though Alex, the guy that plays Alex, is Kramer, in that there is no learning that these characters mm-hmm. can do. So there are limits, right? There's no meaning that they will gain out of existence. And so they can't be central. Because your central characters have to learn lessons, even if you hit the reset button. And Brittany can't, and nor can Alex. And Malone, to some degree, I like to see him maybe, you know, feel sadness and stuff like that. I think I could take him there. But they're kind of, you know. But this, I worked this out in my head. I don't tell the writers necessarily, but I kind of have it worked out. And I can answer any question about any of these characters. Any situation you put them in, I got an answer. And I have to. I'm the showrunner. Mm. I got to make decisions. So I work it out, even though it's my own little highfalutin way. And you can use any way you want. I taught an improv class once where all we did was we started with activity. And I started getting characters just to do physical activity. And so we were starting to physicalize. So I start physicalizing like this, and I develop a physicality now. So this physicality, what is this? This is a guy who's like, what? I got a really itchy ass. Okay, I'm going to play this kind of energy right now, right? Why have I got an itchy ass? Because I had worms when I was a kid. I had really bad worms, and they were itching all the time, these worms, because I didn't get good nutrition, because I had to eat garbage, because my dad was a drunk, right? Out of me just doing this, I can keep going, right? Now I got a character, mm-hmm. right? Now I got a character. You can put him in a sitcom. Do 5 seasons. Get residuals, right? And he's, I love the guy. He's always reaching his ass. I love that. No one knows why, right? They don't know because he ate garbage, right? But I worked it out, right? And I just worked it out right here. That's all it takes, right? It's not like I thought about this, right? I just made a whole character. You can all have it. Put him in your sitcom, right? That's all you got to do is work it out. Now that character can behave. And now you can put him in situations. Right? What happens if he goes where all the seats are made out of ice? Right? And I might get that pitch from a writer, right? And I go, it's a pitch, but let's explore it for a little while. Right? He's always slipping off of his seat, you know? Or what happens if he gets worms again? You know, whatever. You can start pitching those ideas.
One thing that's kind of interesting watching it's important in the premise of the show that, you know, the porter's supposed to make Carl a cool kid because he's a loser at school. And so that's the premise of the show, but yet you've got that funny thing with kids at that age that actor is so likable, and he is kind of cool at the same time. It seems like you're pulling a...
Carl?
Interesting, yeah, you're pulling a neat trick with that character.
And yet the testing... from the kids say, I don't know. I know people like that. They all want to be Porter.
Really?
Porter tests through the roof. All the time. Right? Because we write him as the cool guy.
Right.
And they don't get, like, you know, one of my original, I loved Winnie was the girl.
Oh, Wonder Years.
Years.
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to do a Wonder Years there. But the kids would not get that. They won't get that kind of complexity and confusion in a character. So I keep, like, this works because the two of them are working together as equals. It's not Porter helping Carl. If I do too much of Porter helping Carl, the corollary to that is Carl's a loser. So Carl has to help Porter. We got to write episodes where Carl will help Porter. They're equals, right? It's an odd couple. You know, this show is basically I Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched meets Odd Couple. It's the show,
right?
Right? I'm not inventing anything. I just get, you know, I'll give some characters worms. That's all I'm doing. That's different, right? That's the only thing that's unique. Different parasites. I'm going to teach a whole thing.
The Worm Method.
The Worm Method.
Just say New York Globe and Mail bestseller.
That's
2011.
Right.
So let's get into the writing process a little bit now. You mentioned the development scripts. How many scripts did you have before you went to camera? Talk about how you built your writer's room.
I had three scripts, the pilot, and then two that I broke the stories to, but I co-wrote with a writing team that I like to work with, and I know they'll get the job done for me. And so we met on a – I had worked out the outline. I took as much time as I wanted with it, and then we wrote it on a weekend. They were heavily rewritten when we got to production. They didn't have any real reality. They were actually written to sell the show. A lot of people got to remember this. Like, write the pilot to sell the series, and then you work your way to what you're going to do. Because this craziness up here, I didn't think of it would be that when I was standing in my underpants looking out the Stratford window in the snow. I didn't think that. I just had this, you know, an angel helps this guy, and one of them has worms. That's all I kind of had worked out, right? So it morphed, and I had a big hand in you know, I held the rudder on this ship, but and sent it in a certain direction, but it does its own thing. And in terms of the writing room, I come from an American model of writing. When I was a Mad About You, we had 22 writers.
Wow.
And it wasn't enough. Because we had 168 episodes, so it's like Paul and Helen decide to become belly dancers. We did that, right? So there was 15 people just pitching endlessly to try and sell an idea, and then there was this group of other 8 writers that they did the heavy lifting, the rewriting, and that's that was like the sort of war room, and I was sort of part of that that process. But we had 22 writers, so I like to have a lot of writers. And so I give away generally all of my scripts. I don't take script money so that they get it. So I can give them a modest story editing fee and so that they get a good summer. You come work for me and you get a good summer. You're not going to get super rich, but you'll get trained up to be a really good writer. And you'll stand a much better chance of selling shows, and you'll know what it is to write a sitcom. And then you can go out and hopefully sell your own shows.
So how many writers did you wind up using?
Our first season we had 2, 4, 6 writers, myself and a writer's assistant. And I always encourage my writer's assistant to pitch as much as they want. I want them to. I like people, like, if you're on my staff, you want to come to editing, come to editing. I'm tired and lonely there. I worked all day, and I'd like to have a friendly face to compare an idea to. I bring them to casting, and I also bring a writer or so to the floor to help me with ideas, because I'm always pitching. 10 or 15% of the dialogue, too much water, might change on the floor. If it's not working, I'm going to change it. If it's a big laugh, I'm going to leave it.
What do you like to do in terms of outlines? Do you go long outlines, short outlines? Like, what are the
outlines? We do a beat sheet sort of on a whiteboard, and that's enough to write the episode. But I have other stakeholders I have to serve. I got a studio and a network. And I've developed a great relationship with my studio, and they really trust me, and I've earned it. I've worked really hard to earn it. And there's times I'll let stuff go that they'll go, what the hell is this? Oh, it's going to work out. And it will. I make sure it works out. But, the network, they want to see stuff, right? So you got to give them stuff. So I will generally write the outline before I pitch the story, because I got to make sure it works. I don't want to pitch anything I can't make work. And so I do all that work, and then I'll send it up the food chain. Sometimes it gets killed.
You pitch all the story? Are you the one that pitches the stories to the network?
Yeah, often it's just I'll just send the document on.
Right.
Here's the outline. And if they got questions, they'll go, what the hell is going on in Act 2? They'll write me, or they'll an email, or I'll get on the phone and I'll talk them down. Often I'll pitch problems, I'll pitch solutions that they might have. And the networks are your friends, as horrible as it is to say that. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a kind of ambivalent relationship in that they're really good at knowing what they need, and they're really good at knowing what's wrong with what you're doing. But they're not good at telling you how to make it better. And sometimes they try to, and you got to get really good at kind of winnowing through that. And the really good networks will go, this is not working for us. We're trust you're going to fix it.
Now,
that's brilliant if they can do that.
Where are you getting notes from at this for the show for season one? Was it just Family Channel?
No, I get notes from studio. The process is you write a outline. I get notes from studio. I incorporate those notes. If it's early days or it's a kind of a problematic outline that they had issues with, they might want to see it again. Or they'll go, just send it on. I'll send a network. I'll get their notes. I'll incorporate it. I'll write a first draft. I'll send it to studio. I'll get their notes. Go to network. I'll get their notes. I'll do a second draft. I mean, it's churned. It's a field that's tilled and tilled and tilled endlessly. I do drafts even past them sometimes going, I'm going to fix Act 2. Or, it's not right yet. Don't worry about it. Oh, no, I like it. No, it's going to get better. You'll see. Sometimes I don't have time. And then I try and cram stuff through. I mean, it's a, you know, I'm starting season 2. My writing room is going to start in a few weeks or a few days. And I'm starting to shoot in about 6 or 7 weeks.
Wow.
That's what I had last year. Last year, I had 6 weeks when I got my pickup. And I had 3 ratty-ass scripts and half my cast and no location. And we still did this.
Wow, that's not a lot of time.
It wasn't pleasant.
No, I bet not. But still, even 6, 7 weeks for season 2, that's not a lot of time either.
But I don't want to shoot outside of school, so I don't have to tutor, which takes money away from my budget that I need to have people going in and out of mirrors with. And number 2, my actors... I get one actor, he's like, I don't know what the rules are. My AD's telling me, but it's like, I just go, when does he go home today? 4 o'clock? It's ridiculous. It's the law, okay. But he's like 10, 10, and 12 or some stupid hourly thing, and my lead is gone. So if I have to then take him 2 hours a day for tutoring, it's killing me. So I'm trying to get it done in the summer. Right,
right. Right.
That's, you know, and the network's been very supportive. Say, we know what you're trying to do. We're going to, you know, give you an early pickup and send you on your way, and it's still going to be unpleasant. The only good thing I have this year is I worked out a lot of the crap. I don't have to do those angel transitions, right, that you see sometimes at scene wipes.
Right.
And I know how many pixels that wipe goes, that shoom. And I can do my magic, I call it sprinkle dust or sprinkle juice, when that stuff comes down. And people disappear and stuff. Like, I've worked out a lot of that stuff. And I've got storylines in my brain that I want to see, that I want to try for season 2. So I feel a little okay about that, but still not going to be pleasant.
So when in a few days, you bring those writers back for season 2, and you all start work, and you know you're 7 weeks from camera, walk us through, I mean, how does that work in terms of... I guess that's my question. How the fuck does that work?
Well, I get the studio going... We need to talk about a schedule.
Right.
And I say, listen, I'll get it done, but I don't know when or how. And they say, well, we can't operate like that. And then I'll tell my writer's assistant, Philip, you deal with it because I can't. And he tries all sorts of things and puts cards up on the thing and Velcro this and try to coordinate it and... I don't see him for hours and hours, but I don't have to deal with that. And then I just start working on ideas. And sometimes it's really hard because we don't have anything. But other times someone will say something. And I'll go, yes. The hardest thing is obviously pitching the story out. You know, like that's where we spend all our energy. I can write an episode in a day with my writing room. Mm-hmm. And it takes a day, maybe 2, to make it pretty. Right? I can't do that alone, mm-hmm. by myself. But we break a story, and all the work. It could take 2 weeks to break the stupid thing, and I write it. And it's beautiful in about a day and a half. You two write the first act. You two write the third, the second act, whatever. I'll write the middle act. We assemble at noon.
So you gang write a lot?
Sometimes.
Okay.
If I had the latitude for a big room, I would say, go take a week. But I don't have that. And often I'll say, how many scripts have you contracted to? 2? All right, do you mind? We'll put your name on this. Okay, good. It's easy money. Like, you don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. You're here anyway. And boom, they write it out. And everyone helps. Like, no one's precious about anything. I'll kill any idea, and I'll celebrate any idea. I don't care. Just make it better. You know, just make my job easier. That's all I ask of my writers,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I'm in hell. I'm going to start, like, even now, people are going, you seem weird. It says, I'm girding myself
because
mm-hmm. it's going to get really rough.
But you got a mad dash there, too, it strikes me. If you got 7 weeks before you go to camera, I mean...
Yeah, do the math. There's no good way to do the math.
There's no good math on that.
No.
But also, but then you've got that thing that once you start shooting, you're going to be on that... You're going to be out of the... So how many scripts do you want in play by the time they lose you to production?
Ideally, 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you I'll have 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a war of attrition. Then it will be and you know, I'm changing out some of my writers. I got to educate a bunch of people. Some of them have written for years. They still need to understand my process and the American model way of writing a show. And so I lose time to that. I got to knock the silliness out of them. And also, I, you know, as you can tell, I'm a fairly overt, slightly nutty person. And it's not everyone's appetite, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're one of those precious writers who likes to, you know, sit there and, you know. I don't have time for that. It's like, you know, we're making, it's a TV show. We got to, it's like a, it's more like My Favorite Year. Like, it's that kind of nuttiness that is going to go on. Like I said, I got 6-7 weeks. And I got to have enough stuff. And that stuff that's been gone pitched and gone through drafts and been approved by the network. And then ADs have to get it and directors have to get it and, you know.
You covered some of this right off the top and stuff too. But just to, you know, from the, because you're not a retiring Violet, and we'll get an honest answer. Knock the silliness out of the writers. Like what? What sort of stuff do you, besides what you said in terms of a general... Not an active work ethic. What's the other sort of bad habits that?
Well, some of them are my own peccadillo inclinations. I like 2 spaces after a period. Unless it's an abbreviation, I want my 2 spaces. And I get mad. And sometimes I'll go, "Okay, you don't understand. I like 2 spaces. If it's a semicolon, no." It's 1. It's a comma on the bottom. But if it's a colon, it's 2 spaces. If it's a period, it's 2 spaces. If it's an exclamation point, a question mark, it's 2 spaces. So put 2 spaces there. So they slowly, the 2 spaces come in and the 1 spaces go away. But there's always 1 or 2 that I see. I think they put them there on purpose to see if I'm going to blow a gasket. So that's my own personal predilection. And how I format my documents, that kind of stuff. But, you know, defend the idea if you're going to pitch it. But if I say, no, we're not going to do that, I don't think it's going to work, don't pitch it again.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes I'm sitting there and I'll be on the keyboard sometimes and I'm writing. I hear everything in the room. And sometimes someone will say something and I'll just let it go, but I heard it. And maybe I should say, okay, I heard you, and it's stupid. But sometimes they'll bring it back again. And I'll go, I heard you the first time. Or they think I've forgotten it. And they'll pitch it a week later. And I go, it was bad the first time. At the same time, I don't mind if someone gets all excited and goes, it's going to work because of this and this and this. And I'll go, okay, yes. Now that you say that, that's true. All right, let's explore that. That's worth it. Okay. I get pissed off when I start seeing, sometimes I see people like, they're doing something on Facebook or Instant Messenger. And I know we have to have our lives and stuff like that, but I get suspicious that they're kind of like, what's going on in your room? Oh, we're just shooting the shit. Van Keeken's talking again. It's like that kind of shit, and I don't like that. So don't do that much. There's shit like that I don't like. Show up on time. If you got like a birthday, if your mom's birthday's coming up, I let you to take. I'm happy. Take the day off. Have lives. I don't like people staying late, but some nights you're going to be late. You're going to be there till 11 or 12. I've been on shows where I was on an animated show called Sammy with David Spade, and we had every week 2 all-nighters.
Wow.
Where you start at 10 in the morning and you go all day. And all night, and then you go home around 10 or 11 or 12 the next day and try and sleep for a few hours, and then you come back, and then a day or two later, I do it again. And I almost was made crazy, but Now, work until 11, that's nothing. I know people have lives and stuff like that. And, you know, the good thing is, one of the questions you should ask is, how happily married is your showrunner? If they're happily married, you want to work for them because they want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not, they're going to keep you there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the questions, like, oh, what's going on? Are they split up again? No, I'm going over to, you know, there's a little bit of that going on. And then, yeah, I don't know, a lot of it is just sort of, you know, I have to educate them as to what is a story. Because a lot of people pitch me, you know, he makes friends with one of the worms out of his ass. And I go, okay, that's a good start. Where's it going to go? Oh, that's all I got. Well, that's not a story. That's just an idea. Like, the hardest thing is the third act twist.
Right.
If you don't have that, you got nothing.
So you want somebody to pitch.
It's not necessarily.
It's the idea, like, and the twist as well?
No, if you can, then I'll try and reward you.
Okay.
But it's hard. I mean, often that's what we're banging our head around, right? Anyone can write to the end of the second act, but now what?
Yeah.
Now what? I think in this episode, it'd be hard to sort of say, but I guess the dance-off is really the third act twist. You know, like, you don't see that coming. And that propels the story till its final, you know, conclusion. Or it's too early to say them getting tied up is a twist. It's more of a second act twist. Mm-hmm. The third act twist is, I think, sort of somewhere in that dance-off. And when I got that, when the story was pitched, I was very happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I want to follow up on something you said that I found interesting. It definitely twigged in terms of when you were talking about, you know, don't beat an idea to death if you don't like it, but also defend your ideas. I think that's one of the hardest concepts for new writers to find their way between those two things. And you'll also find it with networks here, too. It's funny. When I was at Banff last year, a bunch of talking to all the U.S. showrunners, talking about U.S. networks, and they were all about, the network wants you to defend your vision if it's your show, right? They want a little bit of pushback.
You.
And they want to help.
They don't want to. If you gave them everything they wanted, they'd be very happy. But sometimes you don't, and they'll let you know, and you got to adjust.
So the question is, for a writer, honestly, I think that sometimes, whether it's part of the Canadian personality or whatever it might be, that idea that, no, you've got to stand up for your idea if you really believe it, is difficult. So what's the difference between...
Well, what's difficult about it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not like that. So, I mean, but I know people who are like, you know, I've seen people wilt with ideas that were good, that they didn't explain the right way, and it's like, and in my heart, I knew that if they fought for that idea and they really showed they were excited about it, it would have made a good thing, and they just fold like a bad chair and go away. So what's the difference between that sort of thing of being somebody that doesn't let go of an idea and pisses off the showrunner, or somebody that invests in the idea and shows you, if you don't buy into it right away, maybe that, you know, that through belief they can maybe change your mind. Where's that line? How can you, do you have any advice of sort of...
I don't know. Keep pitching until they tell you to shut up.
Okay.
And there might be subtle. I'm pretty overt and direct. I don't like subterfuge. I just want to be direct. And some are a little more political. And mm-hmm. So you've got to be able to read that. I'm not good at that. I'm getting better at reading the politics of a situation. And I'm very good at knowing if something's not right. I don't necessarily know why. But I'd rather someone just be direct. And I'll tell them, like, it's not like I want to kill. If it's a good idea, I want that, right? So I don't want to kill an idea. I want them to make, you know, I need 13. We start with just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to 13, and then we start putting cards up. The first draft of the outline, and then we get to crossing off first draft and second draft and network approved, and we've shot it, and it's behind us, and slowly fills up. And, you know, the writers will see. Sometimes I'll just come in, and I'll look at it, and I'll keep saying, we had so little, so few days ago, and now look at it. It's like, you know, like some nut job, right? But it's this, you know, this war. We're making this, it's a huge war, and just, yeah, pitch ideas. The other thing that pisses me off is, at some point, like, I can be wrong. I'm going to be wrong a lot. That's okay. At some point, I have to decide where we're going. And so I'm going to say, we're going to do this story. And I don't, you know, I don't need to see, you know, the pencils, like, right? At the point where we're going that way, then that's the best idea in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And all you got to do is make the showrunner's job easier by making that idea work. Because sometimes I don't have, I got, even last year, we got pitched this idea. I can't even remember what it was. But it didn't work. And I pitched out of some vague remembrance of a former idea, the show that's up, we have here called Dramarama, that is now our season finale. And I just pitched it almost out of my ass. And I didn't have a third act twist, actually. My daughter, who's, it's going to sound very nepotistic, but she's been in show business as long as she's been alive because of me. We were driving editing with Roger Fredericks, who's one of my writers, and she pitched me the third act twist to the episode, and it was glorious. And, and I got on the phone, and I called the writers who were still working out, and I said, and everyone didn't have to order dinner that night. It was wonderful. We had it worked out, and it wrote like a dream, and it's a fantastic episode. It's our series, it's our series ender, and it's going to give us a lot of momentum for the next season. And I had this other idea called School Spirit. And, oh boy, it's like moving a waterbed out of a room that's still full of water all the way through. And now it kind of works, but you thought Spinner and the Saints was trippy. This is Freaky Doodle Town. I mean, it's whacked.
Mm-hmm.
And I barely, like the first time I sent a cut to the network, the email back was, I think we have to reshoot this. And it was basically killing an episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I'm going to fix it. And I did. I got back in editing, and I took a machete to the emo, was my little phrase. I took out all the emotionality of the episode. It was a big emotional deal I was going for. It was basically Carl's mom goes to school to run a bake sale and ends up embarrassing Carl so much that all his popularity cred is diminished. So I wish I wasn't my mom's son for a week, kind of spell gets put on him, which is this trippy thing that sends him into this kind of alternate dimension. And now it's bizarro world where Serge is Sergina and Brittany is the ugly kind of gomi girl and Jane's all made up into looking really gorgeous. And Alex is now the son of Angela. So it's this bizarro world and Carl is stuck in this alternate dimension where coincidentally, an angel in training got zapped to in the 1950s. And she's there, been stuck there. Angels can't get her. She's been there for 60 years. Now they're there together. And somehow this portal opens that Angela, or that Mrs. Lennox, who's the trippy history teacher, is kind of seance-y, hears them. And they get her to kind of tell them where to go, and they open up this portal, and they start to go through. But they both can't get through, and the angel in training uses her magic to send Carl through. And she goes, he goes flying through, and the portal closes up on him. But her angel in training missive was to save a life. And in doing that, she gets her wings and is able to get out, and everyone lives happily ever after. That's hard to pitch on Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it works now. But I was a little bit wrong, I was too ambitious. It should have been a two-parter, and the network wouldn't have given me that first season. Had I done a two-parter where you see Carl watching Alex sitting, wearing his pants and eating his dinner and Sergina and all that kind of craziness, that would have stepped out into two episodes would have been great. But I was wrong. But a lot of the writers agreed with that I was wrong, and they didn't want to get involved in the poop and the shit of it. There's like, well, it's bad. No, it's as good as this is what we got. We got to shoot this ambitious episode. And I didn't like that. I didn't like when the writers, I could tell they're like, yeah, I might have made a mistake, but we've got to go down this road. And I was having to justify the logic of it, and it was hell for me. I felt very alone. You know, I mean, no one liked it.
Mm.
Right? And now it's on later in the season, but it plays, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's funny how, two things out of that. I mean, I guess the first is, at what point in that script process do you know when a story's not working?
Never.
Never really.
Like Spinner and the Saints, the fine little episode. It cuts too fast, and I change stuff, but it's for the kids. I would have edited differently if it was for adults, different jokes, whatever. But you don't know. Like, Dramarama is our season ender. I thought it was going to be good. I thought School Spirit was going to be the season ender. I thought it was going to be fantastic. Still a good episode. Other episodes were shot under time. We had to backfill 3 minutes in one episode with clever cutaways and a kind of tawdry little B story we try to trowel in. But you don't know. I have a better average at guessing what might work now that I've been in the business this long. But I don't know.
It's funny.
You're never going to know. So you hope that they're all that good.
Our time's growing a little bit short, and I wanted to make sure that we threw it open so you guys could ask questions if you want. So does anyone have any questions for Frank here? At the back, please.
Do you a table read?
If I have the time, right? It costs me money to do a table read. I'm not shooting, or I got to pay actors to come in on another day. So often I don't have the latitude for it. Canadian actors don't necessarily bring it on the table read day. And you gotta. And if someone can't make it, because they're otherwise, you know, and again, an American show, I'll buy my actor for the season. They gotta show up. So yeah. They're there. And they'll know that I can, they'll be fired. I've seen people get fired from pilot table reads because they didn't do a good enough read. And the next day, there's someone else shooting in their place. I've seen it many times. And so they bring it. And so I don't know that they're that productive. Sometimes they are. And also, if a writer doesn't like a joke, they'll try and tank it so that someone will say you should rewrite it. And you get into that kind of crap, too. So I don't know. I don't know if I necessarily... On four-camera shows, I think it might be more productive. But on a one-camera or a three, you know, it's like a single-camera show, I don't know.
Right at the back center there.
Going back to the psychology of the young person.
Sure. I'm confused by your question. If this was a teen show, how would I do it differently?
Where would you see the line between what a tween girl wants versus what a teen girl wants?
I don't know what either of them want. And so I write to what I imagine they might want. I don't know that I'm hitting it. I got an email this evening from the network, and they were focus testing another show, and one of the kids piped up that Wingin' It was their favorite show, a girl. I don't know why, other than I'm trying to give them this fun world where there's girls and boys and there's romance and problems, and it's all really just, what's the funnest way we can tell this pretty pedestrian normal story that's been done 150 times? I guess if it was a tween show, The story would be much more complicated and melodramatic, I would imagine. If it was a teen audience, do they even watch those shows? Like, what would be an example of a teen show? Like the OC, The Hills?
But it's interesting to when you look at it, like if you broke down that OC audience when it was on the air and stuff too, that's where your aspirational thing comes into it, right? The teenagers, the young teenagers watching the OC, and people in their 30s were watching the OC.
Well, that's dual departure stuff, yeah. Too, right? WB did a lot of that, right? Like Gilmore Girls, have a young girl and an older woman, and they can both sit down. And I construct that a little bit. Like, there's, you know, I heard someone giggle over, making the escape rope and out of pillowcases, and I didn't want to use my duvet because I was getting some good sleeps. That's a good adult joke, right?
Yeah.
And we throw those in there, too, right? That's not a kid's joke, but it's a good joke, so let's stick it in there. So I'll play to an older audience, and I make all my adult characters are neurotic, except for the mother, and I write her like she's on medication, really. I mean, she has that kind of energy. She's not, but her gestalt or her Jungian-ness is everything is going to be okay. I trust you enough, Carl, that you'll work through it, so I'm not going to get too worried, right? There's not over-anxiousness there, and I just accentuate that a little bit.
Let's
did that answer
more?
Your question?
Yeah.
Yeah? Right, sure. What do
right
I care?
when you have elements of the supernatural and you're like making a story, how do you decide whether the beat is going to be like something magical or something non-magical?
I don't know what that means.
Like, for example, they have the handcuffs, right?
Yeah.
And then they also have the sister in the hallway. Like,
right.
How much supernatural do you put into the story or keep it, you know, from outside characters?
Oh, well, we use it when we feel it's necessary as part of the storytelling. It was critical to the story to have a red halo that was used as handcuffs there. And it's fun, you know, like the books zooming in and out and people appearing. And it's not, they're really cheap. We do them in-house. The CGI stuff, like coming through the mirror, that was horribly difficult to shoot. There was so many problems when we shot it, and our actor pumpkined, and it got really complicated. It was a difficult thing to edit. And we didn't make the most of that moment, but that's all the footage we had, and we're figuring a lot of stuff out. So, and some of it's budget. Like it was, I don't know, $5,000-$6,000 to have those people step out of that mirror, maybe.
Does the magic generally make things worse in the show? Is that is
no?
That
you can fix idea? Stuff. Hmm? You know, we have people beaming in sometimes that they weren't. We didn't beam them in that normally. They walked in. And I found a still that I could use as my plate, and I had enough of a flash that you miss all the moment. Like even in the guy's eating the popcorn, his hand is down. They did a really cool mat where they wipe the hand out in the shot, so you don't see the motion of the hand coming up to get the thing, and you know there's lots of that's going on that you don't necessarily see there. That's saved by a CGI or our own in-house magic stuff. So we use, I mean, the franchise is Angel helps kid. So, you know, you got to deliver. Right? That's what they want to see. At the same time, I'm competing with Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. So I got to find a way to, you know, like it's killed that little delightful raccoon. Right?
That is interesting that they hated the raccoon. We got time for, I think, two more questions. So let's go here.
What happens after two questions? It'd be like, are you just reading that they actually want to go home and you're being polite? Or
Well, go ahead. It's just generally, you know, how long it takes and how long we do these things for.
All right.
Were there concerns when the show was first pitched? Like, how long could it really go with the kids being that age before they started to really age visibly?
Yeah.
So how far can it go before these kids look too old?
I don't know. With hormone injections and a lot of backlighting.
You don't feed them very well.
Enough, four or 5 years. You know, that's why kids' television is generally shot. You get your 65 and out, and you try and do it in as few years as possible. So if it's an issue, I'll have to deal with it. I do think, though, at some point, it's just the character. Like, you don't notice your sister or your wife or your brother aging in a way. They kind of take this meaning on as this signifier, and so they might not even notice a beard on one of the characters in a while, right? It's just, oh, that's Serge, right? I think that can happen, too, right?
The bit with Serge where you pop out of the narrative and you do the threats, yeah. they were hilarious.
Yeah.
The original reason for doing it was I had to shoot a demo pilot, so I couldn't shoot a full episode, and I needed to get a lot of my subtext and my pipe or my exposition out quickly. So I characters just doing to cameras where they said, Serge is a guy that blah, blah, blahs. And then it became a more of a comedic device, but we use it a lot to and also it breaks up a scene. Mm-hmm. I got a scene that's 2 minute, I stick one of those in, now I got 2 1-minute scenes, and it seems peppier. In the case of that Serge thing, we shot about 20 different ones, and I sent 5 that I liked on to the network or the studio, and I said, pick the 3 you like, and we cut 2 of them. We just overshot. That was one of those opportunities to overshoot. But it serves various and sundry purposes. It can be fun. We're going to do a lot more of them, I think, this year. The network quite likes them, and the kids really responded to it, you know.
How many? Congratulations on your pickup. That's awesome news.
Yeah, thank you.
How many did you get picked up for?
Right now, 13, I think.
Right.
is the order, and you know, there's always talk of we might add more or whatever, but I think we're doing 13.
Well, listen, I think this is really terrific. You're incredibly forthright, and I think that there are lots of people here, myself included, that really appreciate that from somebody. And we wish you the best of luck with the series, and thanks very much for sharing with us.
Thanks for listening. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. That's writerstalkingtv, all one word, @gmail.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please log on to iTunes and leave us positive feedback. That helps increase the profile of the show. This podcast is sponsored by the Writers Guild of Canada. The show is produced by Philip Vukovich. I'm Dennis McGrath, reminding you of wise words from the great Harlan Ellison. Anybody can become a writer. The trick is to stay a writer. See y'all next time.